May it please the court. My name is Tom Brandt. I, along with Joshua Skinner and David Upham, represent two elementary school principals, Lynn Swanson, principal of Thomas Elementary, and Jackie Bombchill, the former principal of Razor Elementary. I'm asking this court to reverse the district court and to grant qualified immunity for these two elementary school principals because the law was not clear. This is a qualified immunity appeal. The burden is on the plaintiffs to demonstrate that the law was clearly established. Swanson and Bombchill are not required to prove that their conduct was lawful or to cite to any court decision holding that their conduct was lawful. The burden is on the plaintiffs to prove that it was clearly established that the alleged conduct was unlawful. The question is not whether it was clearly established that Swanson and Bombchill's alleged conduct was lawful, but whether it was clearly established that the alleged conduct was unlawful. 4 weeks ago today, the Second Circuit explained in Doniger versus Niehoff that public school educators should generally be granted qualified immunity in student speech cases because the Supreme Court has left open the possibility of, quote, hitherto unrecognized grounds for regulating student speech. The Doniger court stated, the law governing restrictions on student speech can be difficult and confusing even for lawyers, law professors, and judges. The relevant Supreme Court cases are hard to reconcile, and courts often struggle to determine which standard applies in any particular case. The plaintiffs argue that the existing precedents should be construed in such a way so as to rule that the alleged conduct at issue is unconstitutional. While Swanson and Bombchill respectively disagree with the plaintiff's proposed extension of the free speech clause in the specific context of this case, the primary issue before this court is not whether their conduct was unconstitutional. The primary issue before this court is, as this court has explained in numerous occasions, whether the case law dictates, that is, truly compels, not just suggests or allows or raises a question about, but truly compels the conclusion that the alleged conduct of Swanson and Bombchill violated federal law. That is the central issue of this appeal. In Doniger, the Second Circuit Court concluded that the conduct at issue in that case violated the free speech clause under Tinker. Despite that conclusion, the Second Circuit granted qualified immunity to the educator. As in Doniger, this court should also grant qualified immunity. Lynn Swanson and Jackie Bombchill are caught in the middle. They are caught in the middle in at least two ways. On the micro level, they are caught between the requirements of their employer and the desires of some students and their parents to communicate to a captive audience of elementary school children. On the macro level, they are caught in the middle of a culture war, a much larger dispute which dwarfs them. But before we explore how the principals are caught in the middle, it is appropriate to review the plaintiff's allegations. The plaintiff's allegations, the complaint with the attachments to the complaint, and the plaintiff's application for TRO and the evidence attached to it filed on the first day of the case contain the pleadings and the evidence submitted by the plaintiffs. That's the gold standard upon which I rely for the following five statements. Number one, the plaintiffs have always alleged that the constitutional deprivations alleged in this case were caused by the Plano ISD policies, customs, and practices, and not the individual defendants. That allegation was repeated 33 times in the plaintiff's complaint. Number two, plaintiffs have, from the beginning, alleged that Plano ISD's policy was motivated by a mistaken understanding of the Establishment Clause. Three, plaintiffs have never alleged that Swanson or Bombchill, or the policymakers for that matter, were personally opposed to the message of Christianity or personally opposed to religion in general. Four, plaintiff alleges that other educators in the district agreed with Swanson and Bombchill. Other educators referred to the elementary school classroom as a captive audience, and other educators believed that the rules were different for elementary schools versus secondary schools. Fifth, plaintiff's own pleadings and evidence establishes that both sides' lawyers were involved early on and throughout, and despite that, no agreement could be reached. In other words, reasonable minds differed about the law. Swanson and Bombshell are caught in the middle. On the micro level, Len Swanson and Jackie Bombshell are caught between the requirements of their employer and the desires of some students and their parents to communicate to a captive audience of children in elementary schools. They are caught between the policies of Plano ISD, which restrict the distribution of religious materials, and some elementary school students whose parents want them to distribute those to their classmates, a captive audience. What they see on one side is the school board, the board's policies, the school board's lawyers, the superintendent, and the top lieutenants, all telling them exactly what to do. On the other side, they see some students, their parents, and their lawyers demanding that they do exactly the opposite thing. Meanwhile, the other students and the parents of those other students in the classroom are left unaware. Swanson and Bombshell had a choice. They could obey the people over here who were demanding, they're telling them what to do, their employer and their lawyers. Or they could disobey them and go with the students and parents and their lawyers. The reasonable thing to do in that situation is to choose, as an employee, to obey the employer and their lawyers. The unreasonable thing to do is for these two individuals, Swanson and Bombshell, who are not lawyers, to argue with their lawyers and say, I don't think the Walls decision that you're telling me about means what you say it means. Who are they to argue with the school district's lawyers about the interpretation of the Walls decision? These two elementary schools' principals did what was reasonable, and the district court has left them twisting in the wind, stripped of qualified immunity. On the macro level, Swanson and Bombshell are caught in the middle of a much larger dispute which dwarfs them. On this macro level, Ms. Swanson and Ms. Bombshell must navigate between the opposing sides in the culture wars, wars frequently waged in federal court. Traditionally, education was entrusted nearly exclusively to local authorities, and federal courts rarely intervened except to protect students against grave constitutional violations such as racial inequality or compulsory recitation of prayer. But in the last 50 years, the fierce disagreements in our society over the role of religion in our public schools has become constitutionalized. The rival parties, relying on new and more expansive interpretations of the Establishment Clause on the one hand and the Free Speech Clause on the other, have subjected school districts and officials to countless and contradictory lawsuits for permitting either too little or too much religious speech in public schools. Courts remain divided over the presence of religious materials in public schools, particularly elementary schools. And various courts have held that similar restrictions are not only permitted, but in some cases even required of elementary school educators. The larger conflict enveloping Swanson and Bombshell continues, even as school districts across the state of Texas grapple with the prospect of massive budgetary shortfalls. Restrictions on student speech have been upheld. Restrictions on speech in elementary schools based on viewpoint have been upheld in the 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, and 10th circuits. And restrictions, particularly as to religious speech in high schools, have been upheld by the 6th, 9th, and 10th circuits. The 3rd and 7th circuits have even questioned the application of the First Amendment to elementary school students. And the Third Circuit has upheld restrictions on student speech even during non-instructional time. Some see this dispute as part of the culture wars. In the midst of all this rancor, discord, and confusion, this haze of war, two elementary school principals stand stripped of their protective shield of qualified immunity. The Supreme Court long ago promised that qualified immunity protects all but the plainly incompetent and those who knowingly violate the law. It is time that the Supreme Court's promise be fulfilled for these two public school, long-suffering elementary school educators. The law in this area is anything but clear. Never before had a federal court denied qualified immunity to an educator in a case involving restrictions on religious speech or practice in public schools. Never, that is, until this case. By contrast, many federal courts have granted qualified immunity to public school educators in cases involving restrictions on religious speech or practice in public schools. Those courts have noted that it's very difficult to apply the First Amendment in the public school settings and have, as a consequence, concluded that public school educators should enjoy a generous shield of qualified immunity in such cases. The decision to deny qualified immunity to Swanson and Bombshill stands in stark contrast to the numerous appellate court decisions and numerous statements of legal scholars which all agree on one thing. The law in this area is anything but clear. But wait, isn't viewpoint discrimination clearly against the law? Let's look at that. First of all, that is a broad statement, too broad for the context of qualified immunity. Rousseau versus Hagen demands that we examine qualified immunity based on the specific context of the case. And if significantly, neither did the definition, the elements of viewpoint discrimination, or the extent of its application to student religious speech has been clearly established. In two recent cases that this court has determined, it was held that the animus or disagreement with the message was critical to making a case for viewpoint discrimination. And the score on that is 33-0. 33 times they said in their pleadings that it was because of the school policy that they acted. Zero times did they ever allege that it was because of animus, because they disagreed with the message. Four cases are similar to the context of this question. Of the many cases that we've cited in our
You're open to questions now.
Mr. Brandt, let me ask you this question. Here I am.
Sorry, where are
right
you?
Here. Sorry, it's hard to find everybody. Yeah. Assuming that we were to agree with you that the law was not clearly established so that these particular school personnel were freed from any personal liability, why wouldn't you want us to do what the Second Circuit did, and that is to go ahead and speak to the constitutional issue so that similarly situated administrators, principals, and teachers know what the law is so they would not be twisting in the wind. And this, the in-bank court, we can deal with all our past precedents and give some kind of guidance to schools throughout the three states in this circuit.
Yes, Judge Smith, I understand. My focus, I represent two individuals. I'm trying to get them qualified immunity and out of the case so the case can proceed against the school district, who has also been named. So my concern is to get them out of qualified immunity.
But even as to them, they continue to work in the schools. They may have other situations in which they need guidance.
Absolutely. Guidance would be helpful. But we're not these two individuals are not protagonists in this larger drama. They are just like every other public educator who wants to know what the law is. This court certainly can visit that issue. But my primary argument for my clients is that the law was not clear.
Well, then why was it that you took the position in the trial court to begin with that students have no free speech, no elementary students have no free speech rights?
Your Honor,
wasn't that your position?
No, Your Honor, it was not, respectfully. What happened was inartful pleadings on my part gave that impression. We started our brief with there's two reasons. One, at the time that we argued our motion the original motion dismissed, Pearson had not been decided. So Saucier was the rule, the rigid order of battle.
Well,
so we
had
to take a position.
And that was the position that you staked out, was it not?
No, it was not, Your Honor. What we did was our position was misconstrued. And I understand it might have been because of inartful pleadings on our part. We started our appellate brief with a quote from Clarence Thomas, which seemed to indicate that we were agreeing with him. What we were trying to do there is demonstrate that Tinker was a narrow situation, and that the rule that predated Tinker, which was what Thomas was talking about, was a much broader protection of educators. Our position was that it was not clearly established that the First Amendment applied in this particular context with the distribution. And we were making the point that the Establishment Clause concerns, of course, that's in the First Amendment, those concerns could animate a person
but
to...
But the Establishment Clause is a frivolous argument, is it not? Because the Supreme Court has held numerous times that the Establishment Clause is not to be... that what the district, what any school district permits is not necessarily what it endorses or sponsors.
Your Honor,
that's the excuse that educators have been using for 20 years is this Establishment Clause stuff. And when you talk about private speech, which this was, the Establishment Clause is not at issue.
Well, Your Honor, I'm just trying to tell you that our argument was that it was arguably an Establishment Clause concern they were trying to avoid. Because
but it's not.
Yes, Your Honor, but
yes,
litigation...
You agree now that it's not.
I'm sorry.
I thought you'd answered the question. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry.
Did you ask another question?
Yes, Judge Benavides.
I don't gather the establishment argument was your focus.
It was
not.
But
you did, and I have references. I'm not going to go into it. But you did reference it to the district court. You referenced it to the Court of Appeals. Judge Jones may be correct that perhaps that argument may lack some merit. Don't you have a recent case from a court of appeals that says basically that to allow the distribution of these materials is a violation of the Establishment Clause?
Precisely, Judge Benavides. That's what we're saying. The cases are all
that
over.
That frivolous claim has been upheld by our sister court.
Exactly. That is precisely what we've been arguing.
And does it really hold that to allow the distribution of materials one-on-one on the sidewalk creates an establishment problem?
If you look at Peck, and you look at how Peck has been approved and applied by a district court in Louisiana, they said in Peck that you could not even have a distribution table in the hallway that had Bibles.
This is not a table. This is one student to one student on the sidewalk after school, isn't it, counsel?
There are factual distinctions between Peck and this case, but the point we were trying to make is that if that situation, which is so seemingly more innocuous.
Bibles
or other material.
So if little Michiella was giving out Bibles on the sidewalk after school, that's okay.
Your Honor, the point I'm trying to make is that the distinction is we can make these fine distinctions between the cases, but we're leaving the educators at a loss because they're getting advice from their lawyers that saying, look, you don't need to do that. Please don't do this. And they're not lawyers. They don't have these educated fine distinctions that they can make between the facts in Walls versus the facts here. They're trying to do the best they can in this situation and move forward.
Could I ask a follow-up about the inartful pleading point? It's my understanding that your first issue presented was that the First Amendment free speech clause is not implicated by restrictions on elementary school student-to-student distribution of non-curricular materials. That was, in fact, your issue presented in your blue brief. Do you still maintain that elementary school students do not have First Amendment rights and that the First Amendment is not implicated by elementary school students, or have you backed off of that position?
The position that we took was just as you have read it, but then as you described it next, it was broader.
Okay, well, I'm asking you, do elementary school students have rights?
Certainly they do.
First Amendment rights at the school.
They can wear armbands.
Yes. Yes, they certainly do. They can wear armbands. They have the right to remain silent. They cannot be forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance. They have a right to silent, passive political protest by wearing armbands in high school.
So Tinker applies to them in elementary school, then you're quoting that. You said they have the right to wear armbands. So
no,
if they have the right to wear armbands in elementary, then you're saying Tinker applies to elementary school students.
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay, well, what rights do elementary school students have under your reading of the case?
The simple, straightforward, and honest answer is I don't know, and neither does anyone else. The rights of students in elementary school is an issue that no one knows about. Even Jay Sekulow, who authored one of the briefs, amicus briefs, has been cited in his law review article saying he doesn't think Tinker applies to elementary schools. Well, if a learned author and law school scholar as that thinks that Tinker doesn't apply to elementary schools, who are Jackie Bombshell and Lynn Swanson to say otherwise?
So you believe the speech should be censored not because they're elementary school students, but because it's somehow school-sponsored? Is that your new position, counsel?
No, I'm not saying we're using loaded terms with, and we're talking about censorship. What we're talking about is going back to the Tinker analysis itself. If you look at Tinker, it talks about two things, substantial disruption or the rights of other students. And what we're trying to do, and what educators are trying to do throughout the circuit and throughout the country, are trying to walk that fine line. Because you walk one side too much, you'll get sued for the Establishment Clause. You walk one side too far the other way, you'll get sued under the Free Speech Clause. And that's the
difficult... What do you do? I mean, the best case in your behalf is the Walz case. And
not necessarily, Your Honor.
Because in that case, it's undisputed that the little fellow was allowed to give out whatever his religious things were in the hallways and after school and so on.
No, he was forbidden.
No, sir. It said he did give them out in the hallways after school.
Well, he was.
He
that's
wasn't
not my
allowed
reading
to
of
give
balls.
Them
he,
out in a party, but it says the officials permitted him to distribute the candy canes in the hallway outside the classroom at recess or after school as students were boarding buses.
The Judge Sirico wrote that opinion, and he also wrote the opinion in Bush versus Marple Newton School District. And in Bush versus Marple School District, Judge Sirico said that Walz is sound precedent for the constitutionality of an elementary school restricting the promotion of a religious message precisely because of its religious character.
Okay, so are you saying that Walz does not say that the Egg Harbor School District said that allowing the distribution of materials expressing a religious viewpoint during non-curricular time such as lunch, recess, before and after school, are you saying Walz did not do that?
And I'm
says
sorry, I'm not following your question.
Specifically in the text of Walz, at 187 F-Sub 2nd at 238, that the Egg Harbor Board of Education expressly noted that the distribution of materials expressing a religious viewpoint was allowed during non-curricular times such as lunch, recess, before and after school.
Yes, and this distinction between non-curricular and curricular is a distinction that has begun to lose its meaning and effectiveness, and it's something that federal judges shouldn't be in the business of second-guessing where educators are saying something is curricular or non-curricular. With regard to this case and the prior panel decision in this case, it was determined, even though the district court said the regulations in the lunchroom shouldn't be applied, the Fifth Circuit panel said, oh, yes, we think that the policy should apply.
But Walz dealt with two things. It dealt with candy canes and pencils. And the passages dealing with the candy canes said that's a less of a proselytizing message, and that can be given in the hallways and at recess. But the opinion also points out that with respect to the pencils that said Jesus loves little children, that was proselytizing. The school never permitted those to be distributed any place, and the court upheld that.
Yes, that's right. That's right, Your Honor. And we had actually other cases besides Walz. Walz was so important because that was what the lawyers for the school district were telling their clients, my clients now. But the other cases are the Nuri decision out of the Ninth Circuit, which upheld a ban on the performance of Ave Maria at a high school, also the Gill decision, Peck, and the Roe versus Tangipahoa. And I realize that my time is now out, but I will address these. Thank you.
Thank you. So you have time for rebuttal. I want to recognize we have students here from Alvarado High School in North Texas, so I hope you find this argument interesting this morning. And I hope it makes clear to you what Establishment Clause jurisprudence is about. Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The viewpoint discrimination alleged in this case is remarkably stark. When Stephanie Verscher wanted to distribute a brownie with two pencils attached to it at lunchtime for her half birthday, as was the custom, she was told that the brownie and the moon pencil were okay, but the Jesus pencil was strictly forbidden. Indeed, the Jesus pencil was not even allowed to be distributed outside of school after the school day. When Jonathan Morgan wanted to include a religious explanation of the candy cane in a gift bag clearly marked as from him, he was not allowed to do so, even though secular messages were allowed in the goodie bags and distributed in the class. Those are the allegations in this complaint. As blatant a case of viewpoint discrimination because of religion as one can imagine. And because the allegations of the complaint that have to be taken as true at this stage of the case were so stark, the defendants in this case were forced to make a rather remarkable argument. They argued repeatedly, and it was not inartful, it was intentional, and I would ask you to look at their motion to dismiss that they filed. It's docket entry 173. They start out and they say, well, they allege viewpoint discrimination. We deny that happened, but we understand at this stage we're stuck with that allegation, and we're going to argue that First Amendment rights in elementary school is not clearly established and indeed do not exist. The reason they made that argument is because no other argument would help them at the motion to dismiss stage. Every judge that's heard that argument, five judges, the magistrate, the district court, and the unanimous panel in this case, rejected that argument out of hand. It's indeed an argument that I think if anything is clearly established, it is clearly established that elementary school students are not wholly without First Amendment rights. Now, I can't stress enough, that was not an argument that was being rejected that was some straw man. That was their principal submission and the only argument that was responsive to the viewpoint allegations in this complaint. Maybe further proceedings will show us that those allegations are mistaken, but at this stage we treat them as true. Now, the defendants in this case point to a number of precedents, most of which, by the way, that were decided at the summary judgment or after trial stage, but they point to a bunch of cases that suggest that the law in this general area is unclear. But first of all, if the law were as they suggested, that elementary school students had no First Amendment rights, then the law would be very clear. All these cases would be very short cases. Oh, I'm sorry, this is an elementary school student. Case dismissed, no First Amendment rights. But even in these unclear cases, one thing is crystal clear that emerges from all these cases. Viewpoint discrimination against religious speech, just because it's religion, is strictly verboten. Now, as I say, one of the great things about allegations of viewpoint discrimination is they make all of some of the difficult issues that surround this area recede, because we know you can't engage in viewpoint discrimination. This Court's decisions in the Chu cases are cases in point. There, this Court correctly pointed out that forum doctrine is a little bit unclear. The difference between a limited public forum and a designated public forum is a difficult line to police.
Mr. Goodman, let me ask you, at the line of your argument, and this is really a major problem in this case, it is so general that I'm not sure that it answers the specificity required of the clearly established rule. And you would help us a whole lot if the arguments would get down to the level of specificity that really answers this question here. I mean, I think we can all agree that at a general level, what you've been saying is absolutely correct. Now, let's put this in the context of these kids and these principles and articulate why, in this situation, they should have acted differently.
I'll gladly do that, Judge Garza, but can I say one thing before I do, which is I do think the level of generality discussion that often bedevils clearly qualified immunity cases is less important in the context of viewpoint discrimination, because viewpoint discrimination is forbidden, at least on the basis of religion, is forbidden in every context. And just to finish the thought on Chu, this Court could avoid deciding what kind of forum it was precisely because the Court said that viewpoint discrimination is forbidden in any forum. But to drill down, as you suggest, I think that what happened here, let's take the Verscher example. Okay, the brownie's okay, the moon pencil's okay, the Jesus pencil's not okay. Nothing anywhere tells a school official that that's something that they can do. And that's because five Supreme Court cases, Widmar, Mergens, Lamb's Chapel, Rosenberger, and Good News Club, all say that the message you get when you say any other speech is okay, the moon pencil's okay, but the Jesus pencil's not, that conveys a message of hostility. Now, if you want a case that's pretty close to on point, I'd really ask you to read Judge Easterbrook's opinion for the Seventh Circuit in Hedges against Wakanda School District. That's at 9F3rd, 1295. This is 18 years ago. Now, Judge Easterbrook confronts a school that had a policy, a 1990 policy that expressly said that in the elementary and junior high school, students could not distribute religious material. It was as blatantly viewpoint discriminatory as the allegations at a granular level are here. And Judge Easterbrook made short work of that based on the law in 1993. Now, since then, a lot of issues have arisen in the Seventh Circuit, in other courts, in other places. Harder issues, Bible distribution, T-shirts that are a little like Tinker and a little like something else. But this issue, distribution of something where the school comes in and says, you can do that exact same thing. You can give the moon pencil out, but not the Jesus pencil. Nothing in the law since then has displaced the clarity with which Justice Easterbrook saw the issue, which is you just can't engage in that kind of blatant viewpoint discrimination.
So I want to make absolutely sure that we all understand what you're saying. If a Muslim little girl at one of these parties wanted to distribute a little pencil that said, Ali Akbar, God is great, they have a constitutional right to do that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if a school district tried to say the Jesus pencil is okay, but the Muhammad pencil is not okay, that would, I suppose, be even worse. But the court in Lamb's Chapel and Rosenberger very clearly said that when you single out religious speech and say no to the Jesus pencil, that is viewpoint discrimination. And to the Chief Judge's point about, well, you know, there should be some sympathy for these school district officials because, gee whiz, you know, you have to, it's like Scylla and Charybdis trying to get between the free speech rights and the Establishment Clause. No. The Supreme Court has heard that argument five times, and they've rejected it five times. And what they've said is, you know, this isn't Scylla and Charybdis. This is like, you know, this is like going between Africa and South America, because what you need to do is, if you have neutrality and avoid viewpoint discrimination on the basis of religion, you simultaneously respect the First Amendment free speech rights and avoid Establishment Clause problems.
Here's what I have trouble with several cases, but the Peck case gives me great pause on the clearly established piece, because in a footnote, they had gone through how the school board's or school's policy was total neutrality as to religion. They would let all these groups come in one day a year, secular groups, religious groups, one day a year, and display their materials. It was adult speech to students. They said that the school's taken a totally neutral position. It's fine for everything except elementary schools. And in a footnote, they said, you know, even though it's a neutral policy, because this is an elementary school, this can be viewed as an Establishment Clause violation, and they reversed the district court. Now, this is the Fourth Circuit, a judge we both know. I have a hard time saying that the law is clearly established when Peck says what it says.
Well, Judge Owen, here's the most important thing. Judge Luttig authored that opinion 2 years before the Good News Club case. And in that footnote, he was specifically trying to predict the Supreme Court. Now, Judge Luttig is a terrific judge, but in that instance, he was a bad prognosticator, because in the Good News Club case, the Supreme Court heard to a fairly well the argument that elementary school students are different, elementary schools are different for purposes of their ability to understand that the speech that the school is allowing on a non-discriminatory basis is somehow endorsed by the school. And the majority of the Supreme Court in Good News categorically rejected that argument. So Judge Luttig, like I said, very good judge, but he did not accurately predict what the Supreme Court did. And so if all we had was Peck, it might be a harder case. But in light of the Good News Club case, and everything else he says in Peck is helpful to our side, the one thing he was thinking about carving out was the elementary schools.
Counsel, if we go to, you're relying on Good News. Now, Good News, the only child plaintiffs, most of them were adults. We were talking about children who had the permission of their parents to use facilities after school for a program led by adults. How could good news, having to do with using facilities after school led by adults, inform and make this teacher have to forget this previous case?
Two things, Your Honor, and I think they're both responsive to your question. As in a lot of these cases from the Supreme Court, they first address the First Amendment rights of the plaintiffs. Then they address the argument that somehow the Establishment Clause gives the school district a defense or an ability to restrict the speech. When they're talking about the First Amendment, they don't distinguish at all between the clubs and its members. And so they assume, as you did with your comment earlier about Tinker applying in elementary school, they assume that the elementary school students have free speech, First Amendment free speech rights. Now, when they get to the Establishment Clause, it's true, there are differences with that case. But here's why it's relevant, and here's why it's a complete answer to Peck, is because what they were responding to there, unlike the Free Speech Clause, where they didn't treat elementary school students differently, they, in that Establishment Clause analysis, focused on it, because it was the only argument the school had. You already had Mergens, which is high school, Widmar, and Rosenberger, which are college. So the only argument the school district had in that case is that elementary schools are different. And in the context of specifically the argument that elementary school students would perceive endorsement when middle school students or high school students would not, the Supreme Court rejected that argument. And it reaffirmed
that in the context of an after-hour program led by adults. How could the kids possibly look at endorsement in that situation? How can that analysis under those facts inform the facts specific to our case?
Because the specific argument they heard was that the elementary school students could not perceive the basic fact that the Supreme Court had recognized in every other context. Justice O'Connor's phrase, you've heard it quoted a million times, is that the lesson that the school does not endorse everything it fails to censor is not difficult to understand. That case made clear that elementary school students can understand that message. And the after school is not a distinction from parts of the discrimination alleged in this case. As to Stephanie Verscher and that pencil, it's outside of school, after school hours. So that's really on all fours with the Good News Club case. The reason I think, though, that, I mean, the Supreme Court, and I think this court, has said a number of times, qualified immunity is important, and you want to provide clear guidance. But nobody thinks that you have to have decided this case, exact case, before. And so their argument, especially as they've moved away from the argument that elementary school students have no First Amendment rights at all, has largely been, boy, we needed to avoid the Establishment Clause problem, this conundrum, this dilemma that we're put in. And boy, if the Supreme Court hasn't clearly established something after five cases, I don't know how they ever are going to clearly establish it. And with all due respect to my brethren on the other side, if there are still lawyers telling school officials that you have to keep out the religious speech because otherwise you'll violate the Establishment Clause, well, that's why there is liability in some circumstances.
Mr. Clement, for the sake of argument, my perception is that there are a lot of school lawyers who are doing things like that. And what do you do about the Third Circuit decisions?
Well, I mean, I would start with Waltz. And you pointed to one distinction from Waltz. But there are three distinctions from Waltz. And all of those distinctions are important. One, as you mentioned, they were allowed to distribute the materials outside of the classroom. The second material distinction, and very important, is that was not a viewpoint discriminatory policy. They said you couldn't have essentially pencils with any message. They couldn't be religious, they couldn't be political, they couldn't be commercial. And finally, and in some ways I think this is the most important one, though admittedly the court spent less time on it than I would have, is that in that case, the gifts were distributed through the PTO. So if in that case you were asking a student to understand that, well, the PTO isn't the school, and on that one I'll grant you. That's something I'm not sure I would have understood in high school, let alone in elementary school.
Well, what sort of concerns me is that it's very easy to say that the school controls, if your argument is that if the school controls it, then viewpoint discrimination is okay. I think that goes too far.
Well, I would grant you that. I'm just saying, I mean, those are where the hard lines are. When you're talking about school-sponsored speech, I'll admit it gets murkier. But when you're talking about private student speech, the one thing that's clear is that viewpoint discrimination is verboten. And I think when you look at the allegations of this case, that's what's at issue here. The goodie bags here, they're not from the PTO. They say they're from little Jonathan Morgan. And the pencils, you know, school districts, I certainly have sympathy for them, but we know the judges get absolute immunity. We know the prosecutors get absolute immunity. School administrators don't. There still is some qualified immunity here, and that means there's some kind of law that's clearly established. And if there's one thing that's clearly established is you can't allow private speech and then discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. If they want to say no brownies, no moon pencils, I suppose they can do that, and they can avoid liability. But you cannot say the moon pencil's okay, but the religious pencil's not okay, and it's not even okay after school. What other message are the students going to get other than a message of hostility to religion? And again, with all due respect to the defendants, the Supreme Court repeatedly has talked about this notion that viewpoint discrimination against religion conveys a message of hostility. What they are talking about is objectively a message of hostility. They are not suggesting that there's only a problem if the school district not only engages in viewpoint discrimination, but does it with the explicit motive of we hate religion. I mean, it's the same as in race. I mean, you don't really care if somebody engages in racial discrimination, whether they're doing it because they have racial animus or because they want to get a promotion or because they think it's the right thing to do. It's clearly established you can't do it. And in the same way, in this context, absolute discrimination on the basis of religion, because it's religion, is forbidden. And it's forbidden precisely because the students in this situation, what other message are they going to pick up?
Mr. Clement, let me ask you. You found me more quickly than I thought you would. You are taking this down the road of this being viewpoint discrimination, but allow that if we found it to be school-sponsored, we may be in a different category of case law at all. Taking out the issue of the girl being stopped after hours, just looking at the parties that were held during school hours, the events that happened during school hours, why doesn't this fit within the categories of cases that consider where the speech occurred, when it occurred during after-school hours, where there are teachers there? Don't we have to wrestle with that? And isn't there a good argument from the principal's viewpoint that this was, in fact, school-sponsored?
Well, Judge Southwick, I think that's the kind of thing that you might have to wrestle with, but I don't think you wrestle with it at the motion-to-dismiss stage.
Well, this is a 400-page pleading. We've got a lot before us that we could wrestle with.
You, there's a fair amount you can wrestle with, but you still have to take the allegations of the complaint as a given and in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And if you do that, everything here is alleged to be non-curricular. And with due respect, I mean, I think there's an...
But let me ask you, alleged, meaning that word, that phrase is used in the pleading?
Well, and there's all sorts of supporting allegations to back it up. And I think the other side, if they were the plaintiffs, would have a hard time satisfying the Twombly-Iqbal plausibility standard. I mean, because you're talking about, first of all, a winter party where it's clear that you get to bring in, this is not some instructive winter party, this is you get to bring in anything you want in your goodie bag, and you put your name on it, so everybody knows it's from you, not from the school. Everything else becomes even clearer. This is a half-birthday party at lunch? That's curricular? I mean, I really don't think so, with all due respect. And then, as you point out in your question, the after-school aspect of this, I can't plausibly be construed as non-curricular. So I think it may be that they can point out, after the motion to dismiss stage, that, boy, this really was curricular. They could put on some evidence that somehow, you know, winter parties were a huge teaching opportunity at this particular school. Like I said, based on the allegations of complaint, that seems hard to believe. But they can make that argument. They can also argue, as they suggested in responding with their own motion to dismiss, that they actually didn't do this. They didn't engage in viewpoint discrimination at all. And it may be that at a motion to summary judgment or a later stage in this case will be resolved in their favor. But at this stage, with these stark allegations of viewpoint discrimination, the right answer in this case is to allow this case to go forward and to make it, have this court say that it is clearly established that viewpoint discrimination, as the court said in Chu, is impermissible in any forum, and anybody who thinks that they need to engage in viewpoint discrimination to avoid an Establishment Clause violation is mistaken. Thank you.
Mr. Starr.
May it please the court, Kenneth W. Starr for Amici Marie Barnett Snodgrass, Gathy Barnett Edmonds. The Two Sisters and West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett. The first time that these two sisters have appeared in litigation anywhere, anytime, since West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett. They felt summoned to the cause because of a position that was clearly and unmistakably taken below. And one very helpful thing can be done by this court, sitting in bank, is to completely and irrevocably rebut the notion that elementary school children do not have First Amendment rights. I want to read from the question presented in the opening brief in this case before the panel. Whether the district court erred in denying the motion to dismiss, I impress upon the court, we are at the motion to dismiss stage. Every case that has come forward in the colloquy is a case disposed of on summary judgment, so that there has been an opportunity to explore the facts. Not after trial. We understand qualified immunity should be a shield, but it should not be a shield for this kind of proposition. This is the appellant's proposition to the panel of this court. This is why the Barnett sisters are here. The free speech clause is not implicated by restrictions on elementary school student-to-student distribution of non-curricular materials. Notice, it's not implicated. That is a sweeping argument. That is artful pleading. It may be, how will it be resolved? But the idea that little children do not have free speech rights to be determined with the elementary school dimension taken fully into account is obviously and manifestly wrong. Go to Barnett itself. You don't have to simply have a representation. Read the opinion. Read the opinion since Barnett. But I represent to the court, Marie Barnett, sitting in this courtroom today, was 9 years old. She was in the fourth grade at Slip Hill Grade School when she was expelled from school because of her brave action. Justice Jackson, in that remarkable opinion, overruled Gobitis. Gobitis involved a little 10-year-old boy. It's not suggested that he's too young to be a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. So I hope that at a minimum, this court will, what shall I say? It doesn't need to be clearly said. It needs to send a reminder, memo, that, of course, elementary school children have rights. Now, with respect
to... Mr. Stark, let me ask an implication to your question with the qualified immunity aspect of this. It seems to me that the qualified immunity aspect of this particular case is causing a great deal of difficulty. And who do you say has the burden to show at least that the law was clearly established?
Well, that's on the plaintiffs, and we're prepared to show that.
Now.
And I believe,
and this is my point. At the level of generality that you're arguing, that is to say that children have First Amendment freedom of religious rights or expression rights, will that answer the qualified immunity question? And that's to me a big problem with this scenario. And it's very
Your difficult. Honor, thank you. The purpose of what I have just said at undue length is to say they are wrong. Don't let that argument have any force whatsoever in any opinion issuing from this court that elementary school children don't have rights. That's point one. That's why we're here. But now let's go to qualified immunity. And Judge Garza, I would call the court's attention to the Doug Laycock brief for the Christian Legal Society. And it tells the story of what I think is a clear statement of the law that long antedated, that long preceded the actions here. And that comes out of the Department of Education. You saw it referenced in the briefs, but I really commend to you the Doug Laycock brief. The Department of Education in the Clinton administration spoke to this, and now may I read from the Department of Education, in 1995. By the way, they were reissued virtually in hyperbole under the administration of President Bush 43. To my knowledge, it still stands. My brother will correct me if there's been a revocation of what President Clinton and President Bush 43 did. I dare say I have found no suggestion that it is. And so here's the sentence. Settle law protects students' rights to distribute religious literature to their schoolmates subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. Now, this was a joint statement of organizations that usually do not agree on what my brother has called the culture wars issues. Your Honor, we're not here as part of the culture wars. We're here in the spirit of West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett. The school district has the obligation to follow the law. And the law, as my brother Clement made very clear, has been clear at a minimum since Widmar v. Vinson, and there has been no movement away from it, save with respect to, Judge Owen, some difficult questions as to school-sponsored speech. Is the school sponsoring the speech? Those may be very nifty issues. But happily, what we have not heard anything, because the case hasn't been litigated, is that these are little goodie bags from Johnny to Mary. And that demonstrates and triggers the power of what Justice O'Connor, a voice of moderation, stated in Mergens. The same kind of issue was before the court in Mergens. Well, if you have a Bible club's meeting here, everybody will think there's endorsement. Justice O'Connor's response should ring powerfully in this great courthouse. It is not difficult to distinguish between school speaking and little children speaking. And so the idea that somehow Tinker can be limited to its facts of armbands is to betray a great principle. And if this court has any doubt whatsoever about ringingly reaffirming the rights of elementary school children to engage in this kind of speech and conduct, please go back to Justice Jackson's opinion. Please go back to it. Don't vote in their favor without having reread it, including part two of his opinion, where he responds to Justice Frankfurter's eloquent dissent. It was a mighty dissent, and it was a dissent that was picked up by Justice Black and Tinker. Remember, Tinker was controversial. Justice Hugo Black dissented. And it was picked up very recently, of course, by Justice Thomas in his concurring opinion in Morse v. Frederick. But when you go back to part two of Jackson's opinion, and I dare not paraphrase, but I will, the passage tells us that we understand the criticism that courts are being charged with being school boards. But we have a duty. This is a rule of law. We all operate under the Constitution. And that is your duty, if I may say so, Your Honors. Your duty is to vindicate the Constitution. It's not to make policy sympathetic to the, yes, I understand it. I have represented principals and I've represented school boards. But this is cold on the docks, unconstitutional, with respect to the policy practice, the constant reference to policy practice. The case hasn't been litigated. I've read the one policy, and of course the policy's been up here. Policy of the Plano Independent School District doesn't speak to this at all. What we think the facts may show is that informal policies, we'll see. We'll see what the facts show. But the facts may very well show that there was that which is utterly, utterly inadmissible in a free society built on the rule of law, and that's hostility to religious voices. That's what animates some of the jurisprudence, there's no question. Because of what fear of giving offense, we invoke New York Times versus Sullivan, we invoke all of the Supreme Court's vast body of First Amendment law that said the First Amendment is designed to protect us when we feel uncomfortable. I thank the court.
Mr. Brandt.
Yes. Judge Garza, your question has not been answered. It is a good question, and it is the heart and soul of our appeal. the particularized nature of this right, the contours of this right, have not been sufficiently alleged. I want to begin.
What is the right?
The right that is being alleged is a broad right under the First Amendment.
The right is the right of an elementary school student to say what she wants, even if it means calling another kid fatty.
Your Honor, and
is that unclear?
If a teacher says, Johnny, you can't call that other kid fatty, is that then a constitutional violation by the principal?
It depends on whether there's a disturbance created. That's pretty clear.
Depends on how much she weighs.
I'd like to begin with a joint statement. The joint statement referred to by Mr. Starr was signed on by the Christian Legal Society, and it also says, it talks about a whole category of religious persuasion versus religious harassment. This is a joint statement. But school officials should intercede to stop student religious speech if it turns into religious harassment.
There's no allegation of harassment on this complaint, sir.
But they refer to this document, Your Honor, and I'm referring to the complete statement in the document, which goes on to say where the line to be drawn in particular cases will depend on the age of students. That was the joint statement. So it's not so clear even in that joint statement. Also, they refer to Good News Club, but they do not tell you that Roe came after Good News Club. Most of the cases that we cite came after Good News Club. Roe versus Tangipahoa cited to Peck and said Peck is still good law. So the judge in Roe did not notice that that Good News had changed the law. They had the distinctions as well. They said this was parent speech and it was a limited public forum.
Mr. Brandt, did the court retreat from Tinker or Barnett, for that matter, one little bit in Morse versus Frederick, except for illegal drug use?
I think they did. What they did was they made another ad hoc exception to Tinker, and progressively through the years, Tinker has shrunk in its significance by these constant ad hoc exceptions.
In the course of his plurality opinion in Morse, didn't Chief Justice Roberts specifically say that schools can't ban speech just because it's offensive? Why, he said much political and religious speech could be deemed offensive.
Well, of course, the speech in Morse was drug related, and that's why it was decided the way it was. It was a very narrow ruling by Judge Roberts, and the court focused on the drug speech and said this is a narrow exception. With regard to viewpoint
discrimination, under your argument, use drugs and Jesus loves me are the same thing.
No, Your Honor, they're not.
That's your argument.
With viewpoint discrimination,
essentially for absolute immunity for school officials, anytime religion plays any role in the whole mix.
Respectfully,
and somehow there's no difference then between drug use and Jesus loves me in your argument.
Your Honor, I disagree. Our argument has to do with religion, and religion is a particular issue about which our society does not agree. We all agree, at least those of us who are not criminals, all agree that drug use is wrong. But we don't have an agreement in society about religion or where its place is in our schools.
So isn't the result of your argument that religion, it becomes absolute immunity anytime the topic of religion comes up? Isn't that your argument?
No, and not if Judge Smith's invitation is taken up and this court clarifies it in the future. If this court clarifies it, then there will be no absolute immunity.
What can't they do at the elementary school?
What can't they do?
Yes.
They can't. They have to raise their hand before talking. They have to stay in line.
What can't the school officials do to discriminate? What boundary do they have in religious speech?
They cannot punish a child because they refuse to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
But on religious speech, what religious speech right does the student have under your scenario that's clearly established?
I don't know.
Mr. Brandt, would your principal have had immunity if little Stephanie had decided to say grace before she ate lunch and the principal said no, stop?
I hadn't thought about that, Your Honor, but if that was a silent prayer to herself, no, she would have a right to say. And in fact, as we know, every time there's a test, there's prayer in school. So
what if she holds hands with a friend before lunch and they both pray together?
Well, these examples are interesting, but they're not the facts of this case. What we've got in this, we've got viewpoint discrimination alleged, but it's not clearly established. Remember the scores, 33-0. 33 times they say it's a policy, custom and practice, not just the written policy, the custom and practice caused this. And they never say zero. It's 33 times there. Zero times do they say that these individuals had any disagreement with the policy. And that's a key element in any viewpoint discrimination case, as far as I know, or else it's not clearly established. Thank you.
Make
my time's
the
up.
Custom and practice.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry, what's your question?
What makes a custom and practice?
Well-established law, Your Honor, on that it is a practice of the district that the policymakers are aware of and that they adopt by the proof that it has been happening repeatedly and condoned by the
only
Board of Trustees.
Statement in this record that I've seen does not speak to religious issues at all. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, the policy, custom, or practice, the second
the
part of that.
The written policy in this record.
Right. The written policy does not.
Does not speak to religion in any way.
That's correct.
But okay.
All right.
Now, how is there a custom and practice?
That is for the plaintiffs to allege, and they have alleged that. That's for the plaintiffs to prove, and they haven't proved it. But we take it as an allegation.
We're not at proof.
I'm sorry, but the time has elapsed. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.